Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avantcard. With personalised pricing, our rates are made for you.
We're living through historic times, obviously, and the events we're witnessing now, along with the events of the past, can be better understood through demography. Paul Moreland is the author of The Human Tides, How Populations Shape the Modern World. Afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon.
I suppose it's best, it's probably more useful for the listeners to express this through examples. Tell us about Nigeria and what's probably going to happen to Nigeria over the next few decades.
Well, Nigeria's already had a huge population boom, and it's going to have a population growing four or five times again between now and the end of the century. And the reason for that is that quite basic things in terms of education, in terms of healthcare, really the basics makes a huge difference in demography by bringing down the death rate. In the past, a quarter, a third of children would very often die before their first birthday. Many, many people would not survive long enough to reach fertility themselves. Today, that's all changed. It's still a high infant mortality rate in countries like Nigeria, but much, much lower than it was. But still, women are having very large families. Five, six, seven is quite normal. And so while that goes on, while you've made the progress to much lower mortality, but at the same time, you're still having very large families, the population balloons. It happened back in the British Isles back in the early 19th century. Now that wave has gone all the way around the world. It's hitting sub-Saharan Africa and nowhere more than Nigeria, which is going to have huge challenges to absorb these very large numbers of people.
So, and 800 million is possibly what the population could grow to.
It will hugely depend on how rapidly fertility rates in Nigeria fall. It's almost anyone's guess. But what has surprised people so far is that whereas some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly South Africa, have been very successful at reducing their fertility rates, it's down to kind of between two and three children per woman in South Africa. Most of the rest of the continent, it's coming down quite slowly, particularly in West Africa and particularly in Nigeria. And that could lead to very, very large population by the end of the century.
Because usually would there be when health rates and people live longer, that the birth rate tends to decline? Is there usually a relationship between those two things?
There is. The key thing is the lag. It's the lag between, you know, while the death rate's high and whilst many children die before their first birthday and before they reach maturity, it's very likely that fertility rates are going to stay high, partly because that's just what happens when you've got a poorly educated country with people who don't have many opportunities. At the same, they don't have access to contraception. So when that changes, at the same time as they're able to look after their children better, they tend to have fewer children. But the key thing is the gap between, on the one hand, that drop in the mortality rate, and on the other hand, the lag to the drop in the fertility rate. The longer it is, the more the population grows.
Now, another example, obviously one that's much closer to home, is the demographic changes that have taken place in Ireland over the last couple of 100 years. Prior to the famine, the island was a population of about 8 million people, and we've yet to get back up to that again. If the famine hadn't happened, it would have been fascinating what the outcome of that might have been.
It would have been quite extraordinary when you consider that the populations of Ireland and England were not that different before the famine. Ireland had a very large population boom based on the potato since Elizabethan times. And come the famine, there was obviously a huge setback. We think about the awful cases of people dying and the cases of people leaving the island in terrible circumstances in the immediate years after the famine. But after that, for decade after decade after decade, even up to the lives of the memories of many people who will be listening to you today, Ireland on the one hand had a very, very high birth rate, nothing again like the famine, but a huge emigration rate. Now, the other great thing that happened besides demography in the 19th century was democracy, and particularly after the 1880s, when male suffrage, not yet women, but male suffrage became more or less universal. It wasn't universal, but it's very widespread. Suddenly, all the Irish people, male householders at least, had the vote. So already by the late 19th century, that transformed British politics and put the Irish question right to the top of the agenda of late 19th century British politics. But if there had been the number of Irish people had matched the number of English people, say, by 1900, the way it did back in 1840, it's almost impossible to imagine how the politics of these islands would have evolved,
yeah.
but very, very differently to how they did.
Because the Irish Parliamentary Party would, in the Houses of Commons, would have had a huge representation then.
If they had managed to have one nationalist party, which more or less represented the whole of the Catholic population of Ireland, which turned out to be the case by the end of the 19th century, but if they'd succeeded in doing that, they would have dominated the Parliament.
Yeah. Now, you do use phrases like sort of hard demographic change and soft demographic change. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's actually the theme of my first book. This is my second book. And
yeah.
that was really an argument to say that when groups are in conflict, they use demographic strategies. Having more people is an advantage in a conflict. It gives you more votes. It gives you more strength in a war. And what I mean by hard and soft is hard demographic engineering is when you actually move people in and out. The Irish example would be, for example, on the one hand, the Protestant establishment north of the border encouraging disproportionately Catholic emigration in the 50s and 60s through discriminatory policies in housing and education. That's pretty clear that was happening. On the other hand, the Catholic population was having much larger families, even than the Catholic south of the border. So there's been some quite careful studies done which show that even when you control for things like socioeconomic status, the Catholics north of the border have larger families than those south. And so I think both sides, in a way, were employed in a tacit war of hard demographic engineering. At the same time, there's soft demographic engineering, which is about drawing the boundaries between people, either in terms of their identity or on the map. And, of course, Ireland is a great case of that, because if you look at the Unionist records and, indeed, the Cabinet records around the 1922 partition, the six rather than nine-county Ulster was very much a product of how much can we hold on to demographically, given that by that stage there was almost universal suffrage, and that it would not have been a Protestant Parliament for a Protestant people had it been a nine-county Ulster, and demography was probably the most important determinant of where the border went.
And that demography is ongoing, because a lot of people speculate that in the not-too-distant future there may well be more nationalists than unionists living in Northern Ireland because of that demographic change.
Well, I think that's very likely, but of course nothing's inevitable. And certainly before the Brexit problems, I felt it was quite likely that although it may be that the Catholics become a majority north of the border, at the same time a couple of other things are happening. The boundaries between the two groups are softening, particularly among the middle classes. The ethnic identity, the cultural identity, the religious identity in particular, is becoming softer. And so at the same time, a lot of people who might actually feel we're nationalists, we're Catholics religiously, we might even vote Sinn Féin or certainly for the SDLP politically, that doesn't necessarily mean we want to change the border or have a united Ireland. And I think there's always been a constituency of Catholics, might even call them nationalists with a very small end, and regardless of how they vote, who were kind of quite happy with the status quo.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because there's been a fair amount of reporting here saying that since Brexit happened, that there's now a portion of middle-class unionists thinking, would a united Ireland be better than what's happening on the other side of the Irish Sea? But of course, we can't predict the future of
Brexit. A united Ireland looked very, very, very unlikely in anyone's lifetime. Everything's up for grabs now.
Oh, there'll be fellas waving fivers in the air, betting you, Paul, about that one. Now, Brexit itself, I suppose, is a result to some degree of demographic change or perception of demographic change.
I think to a huge degree. If you actually look at what motivated people to vote for Brexit, it was above all the very rapid immigration into the UK and the very fast population change. Now, you may say, hold on a minute, we can control immigration from outside Europe anyway. Why are people voting for Brexit if what really troubles them is non-European immigration? Of course, partly it was European immigration, because on the ground, very often people are competing against East European, Central Europeans with much lower wage expectations. So there was an element of that. But I think there's also just an element of this was the one chance that people who were not happy about the rapid demographic change in the UK had to vote on something. And I mean, just to put it in proportion, the element of the UK population, which was let's call it not identifying as white British, which it was kind of 8% as recently as 1991. Within 20 years, it had tripled to getting on for somewhat more than 20%, around 20%, double, tripled. So, you know, at that rate of change, it's not surprising there was some kind of political reaction, and I think we've seen it in Brexit.
And on a global scale, obviously, you know, Europe, the West in general, is losing its power and influence over the world, and other parts of the world are becoming better off and perhaps more ascendant. In 100 years' time, will most countries be a different colour, have a different demographic makeup?
Well, I think the world as a whole will. So if you take 1950, there were roughly two Europeans for every African. Mm. By 2100, there are going to be between 4 and 8 Africans for every European. So globally, the world looks very different. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that we have mass immigration from Africa. It's very much down to us and what we wish for. I mean, China, for example, has always had a much bigger population than any country in Europe, but we didn't have mass immigration from China. So we're now living in a more mobile era. There will be more pressure on migration. As to the whether the countries of Europe change their ethnic character through mass migration, I think it's up to them.
Yeah. It's all very interesting. And thank you so much for speaking with us, Paul, today. Paul Moreland is the author of The Human Tide, How Population Shaped the Modern World. We're going to take a break, back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by Avant Card. With personalised pricing, our rates are made for you.